This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Welcome to the Horror Hounds podcast. I was told I need to enunciate that. We're the Lore Hounds, your guides to small town terrors. I'm John.
I'm Alicia, and this is our coverage of It's Welcome to Derry on HBO Max, Season 1, Episode 5, 29 Niebolt Street.
If you want to get into contact with us, send an email to horror@thelorehounds.com or head to our Discord server from the link tree in the show notes.
And if you like what you've heard and want to support us or get ad-free and bonus content, check the same link tree for our Patreon and Supercast subscription options.
So welcome back.
Yay!
Yes, you need not wait another cycle because I am back right on schedule. And Mark continues to be with us as we've tricked him into weekly coverage.
I was going to say, I guess you're the Maddie. You're back, but you might come turn out to be Pennywise in disguise. We have to watch our backs.
Spoilers, but yeah, it doesn't matter.
Did he take the Valium?
Who took the Valium? Mommy's little helper. Did you know Valium was the number one selling drug from like 1968 through like for 8 years?
I mean, I'm not surprised if you make it. Yeah.
That's just insane to me. Like we're just popping benzos at all the women in America.
I mean, it's the easy way to temporarily subdue, you know, it makes you feel calmer. It makes your GABA flow. The problem is that it quickly becomes addictive.
Right. And we were giving it to 20% of women in America at the height, which is just absolutely bonkers. Wow.
And
10%
what?
Of men.
And okay, you said spoilers, but obviously we're going to talk about the episode we were talking about. But what did Lily witness that made her think that three pills was the correct dosage?
You know, I almost made that joke in the intro where the Lorehounds wear three should be enough. You know?
I mean, it tells us about her mom, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You know, popping them like candy. I don't know. Were there restrictions on dosages back then? I feel like they were just like, have some till you feel good. No wonder she doesn't have any emotion when she's dropping her daughter off at the asylum. She's just like straight-eyed, driving under the influence to drop her off. And she's just like, I guess I'm dropping my daughter off for a lobotomy today. That should be grand.
But it just makes me question, what did she witness as a kid?
Yeah.
If only there's a way to answer that in 2027 when we're watching season two.
That's probably true. Probably true. So, hot takes here. We're going to get right into the spoilers. Alicia, you got them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a real meta moment in this episode where Shaw says to Leroy, look, it's time to give you some answers. And he's clearly speaking to the audience. And that's what this is kicking off the second half of this show. And it feels like it's really taking it into a higher gear. I think a lot of people thought it was the best episode yet. And yeah, I have to agree for the most part. I think we've gotten a lot of good character building in this show. And this is, I think, where we start to see, everyone pull together or apart and things take off. And they even, like, when I look at the way we said spoiler, so I look at the way Polly was written, he is a character who was not developed at all. Like we just said that a couple episodes ago. And yet he's like literally just the magical savior bestie. But I was still sad about him dying. You know, they've done that well. My only real gripe is about Tanyel dropping the dagger. I just don't believe it. I just don't believe he was carrying that loosely around in the bag like that.
A little convenient for the plot, but yeah. Yeah, there were a few moments, and I'll let you finish in a second.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a few moments like that where I felt like the plot was moving the characters and not the other way around, and in a bad way. Hmm. And I think that's my biggest critique of the episode, but mostly I agree with you, it was a good episode.
Yeah.
I feel like you'd be holding on to that thing to the point that your hand would be cramping up.
Exactly.
You know, so tightly.
He knows better than almost anybody, you know, what he's walking into, and that's his protection. So I just don't buy that part. But
Well, Alicia, it turns out that when Pennywise sheds into the sewer system, it actually turns water into a lubricant. And so nobody would be able to hold on to that dagger.
Oh, I see. But it's just, he's not even holding it in his hand. He just has it in his bag. Like, no way. Yeah. No way.
Right. That's true.
You'd have that thing in your teeth like a pirate if you needed to.
Like, have it like tied to my arm.
I feel like when she goes, Daniel, keep it close and you'll be safe. You can hear Ron Howard's like, voice going, he didn't.
I'd be like Alicia dagger arms, you know? Anyway.
Nice.
I do have to give back some internet points. Mark, you were correct that the pillars are indeed the boundaries of Derry. But I'm taking back the theory about Marge. Now that we know Marge didn't lose her eye, she could still be Margaret Tozier. So putting that out there. But yeah, overall, love the episode, especially love the cinematography. I love the way like the camera was moving through the sewers and like the steady zooming pace that sort of heightened the anxiety. And also there was this really cool shot that stood out to me that was mimicking one of the movies where there's a train passing over a highway at an angle and the kids are walking through the grass beneath it. And this was an even better version than that famous movie shot. So just the cinematography, we haven't been talking about it, but it's also been superlative on this show.
Very nice, David.
What do you think?
I'm just joking because he gets so obsessed in the minutia of that.
Yeah.
She didn't say the name of the camera angle type, though.
Right.
So. It was a Dutch angle. No, it wasn't.
This is a booby Oz shot. You know, I don't know. I started on my takes with you, so I'll just continue quick. Mm-hmm. I think this was, on first watch, I was not a huge fan of the episode compared to the others. Like, I started to see some seams cracking, and I stand by some of those criticisms of, like I was saying, the plot moving the characters rather than the characters moving the plot, seeing the writer's hand a little bit. I thought that was popping up a little bit more. And a little bit of the dialogue was like, this is very, very show. This is very, very tell not show. But overall it worked really well. For me, this is a great show for me because I like diving into the lore, and this is, now we are getting a lore, you know, Native American, Indigenous American backstory for the history of it, and I think that's great. That's fun. I was trying to find out from Mark if the Galoo is from the books at all, even from like Dark Tower, and Mark, you've answered in the negative.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to break it to you. You have two options that are equally time consuming if you want to really learn the lore. Because you've got to learn about the beams and the guardians of the beams. And so you have two options. You can either listen to half of our podcast from last week, or you can read the entire 7-book Dark Tower series, which might actually be faster because the Galoo is just one piece. The Galoo is not from the books, but we really, really got into the lore last episode. So choose your poison, one of those two. Put the podcast at 2.5x speed, and it'll be a little faster than reading 7 books.
Fair enough.
Well, I wanted to ask you also about the prior two episodes since we didn't hear from you.
Oh, man. I'm not going to be able to separate them because I've been catch up. Sure. But I actually enjoy those more, which is why I was, when I logged onto Discord and people were like, this is the best episode yet, I was like, oh, interesting. but I don't know if that's because I binged it and I might have been fatigued by the show by that point. Like, I don't think this is a good binge show. I think this is really a show that's best watched week to week. And I know we have people on both sides of that debate. Should we release everything as binge and everything as weekly? And I think that there's probably a middle ground where, like, some things are better as binge, some things are better as weekly. And this is definitely on the weekly show for me. Because first of all, it's long. It's very lore dense. And so you want to be able to digest that before next week. And I think by the time I watched this episode, I was just like, okay, all right. More budget Harrison Ford explaining to me what's going on underground. I don't know if I could do that right now. On rewatch, I liked it a lot better because I was coming in fresher and I didn't have to follow things as closely. And I do think that the chemistry between, you know, over the last few episodes, the chemistry between the new Losers Club, which I've referred to in this outline of Square Central. I didn't get a chance to listen to your last podcast, so I don't know if you've already named them.
No.
All right. Well, I'm calling them Square Central from episode two. And I do think that their chemistry is really good. And that's so important for an It show because it's all about, you know, friendship and, you know, the Losers Club. And let's get everybody together to fight the big bad.
Right.
And that's all I got. I think overall, I really like this episode, I want to say. Like, especially on rewatch, I really liked it a lot better. Mark, give us your top
takes. Okay. I have not looked through the Discord about this episode yet because I didn't watch this until yesterday. We're recording on Tuesday. I didn't watch it until yesterday, so I had already... I was a day behind everybody else, and I didn't want to be spoiled, right,
by the time I watched it. It doesn't even open until Monday in everywhere outside the Americas.
I thought it was Sunday.
Sunday night for you, so...
Right. So I didn't watch it until Monday in Estados Unidos, and... So I didn't know that everybody thought this was the best. So I think, speaking of Discord, I feel like I've been ruined a little bit by Discord because, well, let me just say, I liked this episode. I enjoyed it as what it was. I have a lot of quibbles about the writerly aspects of it, though. And I feel like I've been a little... I'm going to decide my take on this episode as this conversation unfolds, honestly. And the reason I say I think I was ruined by the Discord is that somebody said something on the thread for our episode 4 coverage about how nice it is that we're fans of this and that we're enjoying it, whereas some other Stephen King fans podcast they've been listening to are really harsh on the show and complaining. And I feel like that I'm like, oh no, now I'm like not liking this as much as I was watching it. Like that kept like coming up in my brain. I don't think this was my favorite episode. Maybe by the end of this conversation, I will decide it is my favorite episode, but there were just some things about it that kind of like rubbed me the wrong way in terms of the way the mission all came together. Like it, just from a plotting perspective, I think I'm with John that it's kind of the plot drove the characters, which is not really how Stephen King will operate until the last 15% of the novel, and then Deus Ex Machina can take over.
which by the way, Mark, almost literally. I totally agree with you on that point. I've read the first 100 pages of the It novel now just to dip my toe in, and I learned two things. One, he's very character driven. Two, he really likes to say slurs, maybe a little too much.
A lot of them.
Wait, Stephen concepts. King, why are we doing this? Stop, you're a white guy. You can't do this.
Yeah.
But you know, there's certain King novels fizzle at the end is a common criticism. I'm not going to say I completely agree.
Right. I mean, he mocks that himself in this book. Like he has.
Really? I don't even remember that.
Or is it only the... I think it's in the book as well, but yeah, the Bill character, which is a Stephen King stand-in, he is constantly being made fun of that, you know, he always drops the ball at the end.
That's not surprising at all. Yeah, there's often a writer stand-in, by the way, in these, for folks that don't know, and I don't even mean necessarily just like, just a stand-in for him, like a literal writer character, a professional author,
right.
Or sometimes in one of his most recent books, a poet. For example, right. but that's less common.
I think this is one of the most like literal Stephen King like ones yet.
Yeah, I would say Bill Denbrough definitely. So, yeah, I think this episode was good horror. I think the scares were more real. I think they, even the sort of CGI crazy clown frozen face was cool looking. Like, I didn't think this was nearly as creaky as some of the other. I've been complaining, John, about some of the weird.
I heard. I didn't even listen to the podcast that I heard about.
Yeah. But the last couple episodes have all been improvements on that. And this was similar. I'm on the line on this one. And it has to do with kind of just what the implications of the story of this all are. And so I think we're going to. And not from a lore standpoint, more from a plotting standpoint. So I'm looking forward to getting into it and pissing some people off on the Discord.
Excellent. You know what? I think it's good to be genuine in our takes. I will say I'm more forgiving of bad CGI than you as a child of the prequel trilogy. I just, I don't know. I it's almost charming to me sometimes, the bad CGI. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, we're in it. We're back in it with Anakin.
I thought the CGI in this episode was great, especially that,
I do too.
So do I. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It looks very real.
It was wonky in the graveyard. The graveyard, we all agree, right. Not where they threw their budget.
Look, it was 1995 Casper? Yeah, but it was fun, you know?
I loved that movie.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I got sucked into watching a clip of it. And it made me want to rewatch it. And
I just watched it with my kids for the season a few weeks ago. And the CGI in that movie is better than when I watched the prequel trilogy with them a few months before that. Like, that's better than episode one. And that's 1995. I feel like it's better than episode one, the way it's integrates with the sort of real life meat space, you know. Anyways.
Well, we're not here for Casper. We're here for Pennywise the Dancing Clown, and I think it's time to get right into it. So let's get to Square Central. It's growing, baby. We're growing the club here. Marge takes the blame off Lily and apologizes to her for not believing her sooner. She joins the Pennywise resistance group in their secret headquarters, only for none other than Maddie to appear. I think I've reversed that a little bit. Maddie appears and then Marge comes later, but, you know, we'll forgive it for my outline. Looking haggard, Maddie. Well, the group wants to take Maddie to the police. He refuses out of fear of his abusive father. He tells them Teddy and Susie are dead, but Phil remains alive in the sewers. The group agrees to go there to find their friend.
Yeah, so this was, I have to say, I fell for this for far too long. First of all, because they set us as the audience and Lily up to believe this is real because of that whole scare she had with the pickle jars, where there were the cereal boxes and all of the kids decayed on the cover, on the fronts, except for Maddie and Phil. So I'm like, oh, they're alive. Because, you know, sometimes he does stash people down there. And because I was kind of almost expecting that, I looked over things like he says that he can only hunt during the day and at night, and he sleeps during the day. And we know that not to be true. We see him do daytime scares all the time. So,
yeah. Yeah. When I was looking back, I was like, oh, but then you have Johnny Appleseed. Is that who the statue is?
Paul Bunyan.
Thank you. Paul Bunyan, that whole thing, that whole scare with Richie in the second movie. And I'm like, oh, no, he could definitely do nonsense in the daytime. What are we talking about?
I mean, he scared these kids themselves during the day. You know, Marge with the eye thing last week was during the day.
Yeah. No, in retrospect, also people were pointing out, like, the way that Maddie reaches his arm and grabs the tent is very Pennywise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And, like, why does he have a tent? You know? Well, like, so I'm not going to claim that I totally saw it coming, but I was wondering, this is either Pennywise or this show is losing me more, because my whole thing was, I had in my notes as I was watching this first scene that he appears, like, there's no way this kid would be awake, let alone escape, right? He would be comatose like he's claiming Phil was. And then it's like, oh, because he's not real. Because those kids don't know that, right? There's no way that they would know that it would be essentially impossible for somebody in that context to escape. And no, it was the show playing honestly with us. Like, you're right, that wouldn't happen because it didn't happen. But right. I can't claim internet points because I was also like, yeah, but they might be changing things. This might be a different kind of power set anyways. But yeah, it's cool. Yeah. It's nice to... They've allowed themselves from a plot setup a chance to do that in a way that we don't get in the original novel because we have this Generation One group of kids that gets captured or killed, right? We get this opportunity of what happened to the first kids, whereas we, in the original story, just really Georgie. I know there are other kids that disappear, but nobody that's connected to these kids that we could right. do this impactful moment because Georgie is, from the reader perspective, we know he's dead, right? And maybe his brother and his friends don't know that, but we get this possibility because of what Alicia was saying of the cereal boxes and all these illusions. So pretty cool moment. I'm glad they didn't break their own kind of rules or whatever, but good trick.
I do agree. It would have felt very cheap to have it end up being Maddie after all those slips. But I wonder, do you think that they should have not gone with the cereal box clue? Because do you think that was, you know, a chance for reader, was that deliberately misleading someone in a way that like you couldn't have gone back and predicted it? Because the best twists are ones that when you go back, you can predict it, right?
Well, I mean, when you look through what he said during this, it should have been obvious as the way it's grabbed. And I thought that was just the writer, you know, the way he grabbed out of the tent. And I thought that was just the writers messing with us. But then all the things about like lying about, you know, Pennywise hunts at night, and also the whole don't go to the parents or the police. And now we have, because the show's taken the time to get there, we have the kids at a place where we understand why they want to go to neither their parents nor the police, because they're like, yeah, no, yep, they don't believe us, that tracks. So it's, in retrospect, it should have been, it was like a facepalm moment for me, like, obviously. And when I realized it, by the way, was when they were walking through the sewers and he was clearly not affected by the Valium like the rest. I'm like, okay. It should have been obvious, because I think that it did set it all up.
I would say, to answer just the question about the cereal boxes, think of that as a character moment more than for us. Think of that as things that would set up in Lily's mind that Maddie could be alive, that Phil could be alive. Right. So sure, it plays tricks on us, but what it sets up is this very real possibility that if she ever saw a trick version of Maddie or Phil, she'd be more likely to believe it, because she didn't see, she saw Susie's arm get ripped off. So she doesn't, if she saw a fully intact Susie, she's going to go, you're a hallucination, right? Not true with Maddie. She wanted to believe Maddie was still alive. And that is sort of, I guess, baked into some of those early scenes
right.
in that first or second episode.
All right. You've convinced me.
Do we think, so we had the whole conversation last week about the chemicals that, you know, they were talking about Pennywise liking the adrenaline and cortisol. And then we hear that Pennywise is eating brains. Do we think, but this was coming again from fake Maddie, so we don't know if we can believe any of that. Does Pennywise like to eat brains, or is that just playing on a zombie trope?
I mean, I don't know. Mark, you're the lore expert.
I mean, I'm sure Pennywise does, but he does everything, right? He'll eat everything. He right. sucks your soul. He does whatever. I still feel like that was that line. It was a throwaway that a 12-year-old said, right? Like, do we know for sure that predators seek the chemicals that makes it? We know in the lore that it salts the meat for Pennywise, but do I know that my dog loves the fear if he's chasing a squirrel? Like, I don't know that that's true. So, like,
no, I feel, I mean, like, it doesn't matter, just for, you know? Pennywise. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. I don't know that. My take last week, John, was essentially it's metaphysical. I don't think it has to be actually midichlorians or whatever here. But I don't know.
See, again, I'm more forgiving because of the midichlorians. My prequel trilogy experience has primed me to accept this lore, right? This can be both, right? It could be the magic and the science.
And what I would say is to the real fundamentals of the question, back to the whole idea of the cereal boxes, is it makes it believable for the kids. The kids heard Will, the smart kid of them, right? The learned 12 and a half year old or whatever. And he said this thing about predators and chemicals, and they bought it. And so to have another one of their friends say he's eating brains, that probably all makes it feel more real to them. So, because Pennywise knows that probably on some level, he can read their minds and stuff, right? So it doesn't have to be true or not true. What matters is what they believe in this context, certainly.
Is anyone else, by the way, worried about Rich? Because, okay, here's my theory. My theory is that first of all, I'm worried about him and his planes because they remind me of Georgie and his boat. And my theory is that he's going to die and then Margaret's going to grow up and name her son after him.
She Margaret?
We don't know yet, but now that she's kept her eye, it's back on the table. It makes sense. It's a small town. These kids have to grow up to be the next generation's parents. We know that for a fact with one of them so far.
Yeah. It's a small town, but I feel like people move in and out of it quite a lot.
Sure. Yeah. It doesn't have to be, but
it's a small town based on Bangor, Maine, and Bangor, Maine has still tens of thousands of people, right?
It's smaller than Bangor, Maine though, right? Because don't they refer to Bangor as a location also?
I don't know that Bangor exists.
I will tell you that I read it last night that Richie was flying into, he's going to Boston and then flying, connecting a flight to Bangor and then taking a car from there.
So it's separate town. Look, we don't need to relitigate this because we're just going to watch and find out. But to me, oh my God, I forgot. What did you just, before we got distracted by airports, the idea,
Is Margaret Richie's mom?
Mm-hmm. Right. Sorry. Sorry. It's still early, folks. For me, it's fundamentally just why doesn't that come up in the It novel? Right. And there are plenty of wave of
this
your
character
hand
doesn't exist in the It novel. They're expanding the It novel with this show.
No, but Richie Tozier 100% does.
And yeah, but we don't hear his mom's whole backstory.
But Hunter from the previous generation, they've taught us, would probably have the capacity beyond a regular old dumb adult in Derry.
I mean, and this is not the same canon as the novel either. It's based on the novel, but
In the film, there's no scene where his mother talks to Richie about it, right? We feel like Richie's family is one of the more functioning families. Because we don't hear of terrible abuse, right? Which is already way better than a lot of the other losers.
I mean, they'd be retconning it, to be honest, but I don't mind that.
Right, and they could be retconning it, but I guess I don't want to be in the... There's enough connections that, I'm not going to assume Marge is the same as Margaret and there's some secret,
It
feels a little bit like the second half of Wicked.
It's just my theory, just putting
go.
It on the table. So, I rest my case.
I'll just say, I hope it's not true because then they have to, they've got to have the web episode for 9 minutes that shows a scene where her actor in the first movie is deciding not to talk to him about it. It just breaks what we learn about what happens to you when you grow up if you were
I don't think I agree.
I don't know. I could see, Mike is someone who intentionally tried to remember, right? Dedicated his whole life to remembering, and I do think that, and again, Mark,
like Rose, you're the
Mike Hanlon, sorry,
no, but I'm saying like Rose.
Right,
adult too.
Oh, I thought you said Mike Rose, and I was like, I don't know who that is. But no, but Mike Hanlon dedicated his life, right, to remembering and being the historian for this. Whereas I do think that the adults in Derry, a lot of them have had these experiences and chose to forget, right? It was just traumatic. And if you choose to forget in Derry, you're going to forget. Pennywise is going to help you out there.
This for me is all about the sort of what's the thing y'all talk about the test of whether something's a good adaptation or whatever? Like
the Shippey test, yeah.
Shippey, yes. So for me, I'm not saying this isn't true, that what you're positing. I'm saying, but that's the kind of thing that I don't want to be true, because what it is, because to me, and this is spoiler for later in the conversation, some of the issues that I have with this episode have to do with what it is, not the lore, but like what the story of it is and what the sort of central idea about what makes it that story, and not the Dark Tower, and not Stranger Things or other properties, right? And
it has to do with the way nailing that, though, personally.
I know. And something like, and so what it is what makes a loser's club, and what makes the psychology of a loser's club, and what happens to the losers as they grow older. Mm-hmm. And so if like there couldn't have been, the seven of them grow up in the original It story, and one of them doesn't survive because he kills himself, but none of them turn into bad guys that join its side. None of them, they either refuse they either accept the call to fight, or they are too terrified to do so. This story is about love and about friendship, right? Yeah. And so the idea that Marge grows up and
she's not
leaves
bad.
Leaves her son to do this alone and not be like, so I guess what I'm saying is what it feels like they're telling us in the entire 1,000-page novel or whatever, and the other adaptations, is that if you were a kid who fought it, even if you died, you're special, and you have a bond with the rest of your team, that this would break a little bit. So I'm not at all saying it's not right. I'm saying that I don't think I like it. Like the bird, put it this way, they've got an uphill climb. Okay, if they do that, they have to sell it.
It was a stupid reach theory, so I retract it. But listeners, maybe.
No,
I would personally find it a little bit satisfying. But
they got a lot of work to do to make it good. All I'm saying is they got a lot of work to make it actually not break the vibe a little bit. That's the thing. That doesn't mean they won't.
I actually kind of want to push back more.
Do it.
I just want to say, like, to me, and again, like, I haven't read the full novel, so I'm gonna, you know, you have more cred than I do, Mark, on this. But to me, a central point of it is how adults can ignore the cycle of violence that was perpetuated against themselves as children and are now being perpetuated against their children, right? Like, this idea, because, you know, I think I talked about this in an earlier episode, like there was kind of a thing in the 1960s where people like confronted the fact that as a nation, we kind of confronted the fact that fathers were abusing children rather than just strangers were abusing children. Right. And you know, for the first time we were like, hey, maybe it's not good to like hit our kids. And like this idea was like emerging, and that was sort of in the late 60s. So I think a lot of the story of it is people ignoring the atrocities around them because it's just part of the vibe, right? That's just part of society, and you just accept and you look the other way. And we see that with Charlotte being looked at as the weird one for interrupting the boys beating up the kid, right? And so I do think that it's possible that Marge goes through all this, wants to forget because maybe all her friends die or some of her friends die, and she grows up and is just kind of numb to it.
Maybe she has her own kid of Mommy's Little Helper.
That's right.
She's learning.
It's a lot about where this goes, right? Mm-hmm. So like Marge's arc is already her flirting with abandoning her friends and kind of joining the bad guys. So like there's a setup where like this is true, and Marge's story in this season ends on a note that makes me go, oh yeah, well, she's gonna turtle. Probably shouldn't use that term because that doesn't mean the same thing. She's gonna lock herself in her shell and just ignore the rest of this for the rest of her life. There's a version of this where she essentially abandons the quest, or she would. I mean, and that actually in that case would be a satisfying character arc because that was a struggle they've showed. But if this, it's all about what they do with these characters now. If it goes the way of, you know, the later group where they team up and they, through force of will, not the character, the mental state, they fight back and they beat Pennywise and they all have sex in the sewer together to like show their bond, right? Just like the original Losers Club did and whatever. Then Marge grows up and abandons her son to it. I don't buy that. But if the struggle that she's facing continues, then we're right in the hands of what John's saying, which is that Derry makes the adults ignore atrocities, right? Which is true. But the other X factor here is the adults that are actually dealing with this right now, right? Which is a very different, those adults are not ignoring it, but those adults are not either compassionate and fueled by fraternity and things like that and love for their kids. So there are a lot of variables in there that could make this completely satisfying. Ever since probably the first season, first scene, I've been like, all right, I'm cautiously enjoying this, right? But at any minute, they could make choices that make it awesomer or make me go, oh no, you're kind of like busting the vibe here. So this is one of those things.
All right, I just want to run one thing by you guys, because this is something that Maya, my darling wife, pointed out to me, is that, and maybe you mentioned this on an earlier podcast that I didn't hear, but Marge's eyes often have like an orangey yellowish light in them. Mm. Her glasses for the first half of the season. And I don't know if that was foreshadowing the attack on her eyes by Pennywise, or if that's foreshadowing that she will eventually work in Pennywise's interest.
Wild. Haven't noticed it. That's pretty cool.
It'll be like the projector reflecting. Cool. It'll be like the sun, you know, all these random things. And you're like, but how many times can that happen before it's not a coincidence and it's intentional?
How many of these kids do we think are going to make it out of this season?
Two.
They could fail, right? This ends, and we'll talk about the augury later or whatever, right? But like this all, we have no reason to think this always is successful, mm-mm, right? So we
know
think
it's not.
That, well, we think that like,
in the second movie, they show the tribe being unsuccessful.
Right. So, like, it feels like we have two options. Every cycle, Pennywise is beaten back before he's done, or Pennywise just satiates itself and sleeps for 27 years. And I think it would be appropriate for some of these seasons to vary in that result. And that doesn't mean all the kids die, but they might not win, right? And it could be that some of them die. I don't, are we putting internet points on this? Like, I have zero idea. I'm worried about all of them. But I do think...
Except Will. Will's...
Two of them? Except Will, that's true, right? So I do think, and Marge apparently, I do think we're...
No, I'm not saying, it's just a theory. It's just an option.
And in fairness, I guess Will could die and the Hanlons could just have another kid.
Named Will.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe people do that. I don't. Yeah. Maybe I wouldn't do it, but people do it.
I do think we're, you know, like Game of Thrones had like major character deaths in fits and starts. Walking Dead the same. Like shocking moment, and then like you'd go a while, and there'd be another one, but then you'd go entire seasons where nobody important ever dies, right? And I'm speaking of the show Game of Thrones, not the novel series. But so I do feel like we're kind of there in the sense that this is, I should not say this out loud because I'll be proved wrong next Sunday night. But like we had all those kids get killed in the first episode. I think we've got these kids for a few more episodes. And if there's massive loss, it's going to be at the end of this season. That's my guess. Like we're not reconstituting a Losers Club again. I think getting and losing Maddie in this episode again might kind of serve that purpose. That's the only thing I'll put internet points on, but all bets are off otherwise.
Maddie, of course, like 3 inches taller because, of course, they had an 8-month gap in filming because of the writer's strike.
Right.
And all these kids had growth spurts, which is like, kind of funny. And this was the first episode after the break, to be clear.
Yeah. It allowed Bill Skarsgård to come back, so.
Oh, is that what happened?
Mm-hmm. He was he had a filming conflict, and then when the writer's strike delayed filming, conflict went away.
All right, well, let's take a break and then we'll continue on the episode.
Uh-oh. The holidays are really coming up fast, aren't they? But to quote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, don't panic. Uncommon Goods has you covered, giving you access to thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can browse stress-free from the comfort of your own couch. And if Hitchhiker's Guide fans want to follow that book's other most important piece of advice, but find that you do not in fact know where your towel is, Uncommon Goods can help you out there too. From a wearable toga towel to a beach towel that doubles as a backgammon board, complete with oversized wooden playing pieces. Hello, my name is Alicia, and I am addicted to Uncommon Goods. I honestly can't think of another site that has something for everyone in my family, from my sports-loving dad, to my foodie mom, to my sister, the board game fan. Whatever you choose will feel special, personal, high quality. It will be something your recipients keep, something that makes them feel seen. Uncommon Goods likes to stock products from independent craftsmen or small businesses, which are often handmade or in the U.S., so you can feel good about where your money's going, especially since with every purchase you make, Uncommon Goods will give $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. And bonus, we can help you score a 15% discount. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/lorehounds. That's uncommongoods.com/lorehounds for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
We're back to observe a clandestine meeting. Alicia, you want to read it?
The Secret Guardians of Its Cage from this
Scottawapscott.
Scottawapscott.
I practiced
tribe.
It yesterday.
Yeah, all right.
When I was outlining this.
This is not a real tribe, by the way. We'll talk about it in a minute. Meet to discuss the status of this Galoo cycle. They note the number of deaths and disappearances, but seem mostly pleased with the low level of violence. They also note that it has been shedding into the water supply, making the residents of Derry more aggressive. They suspect that the augury, a final large violent event to end the cycle, is coming. Rose learns that Taniel has been taken. So, yeah, there's the Scottawapscott tribe, and then, but the tribe, the name they used, also not a real name, in the It movies was the Shokopiwa. So why did they change the made-up name of the tribe? I wish they had addressed this in the on the podcast. I was trying to look into it. I can't find any. I don't, you know, we talked a bit before about the Wabanaki were the consultants that they use, and I'm assuming that they're using Wabanaki language. But then the Wabanaki, they're like the Iroquois, where, you know, Wabanaki is the name of the overall nation. Iroquois is the name of the overall nation, but Mohawk is a type of member of the Iroquois nation, Penobscot. So maybe it's something like that, where one is like a larger collective name, or maybe there's something like we talked about in the subscriber feed, we talked about during the Prey episode, that the Comanche name that we use is actually the name another tribe uses for them that means enemy. And then they have their own name, like the Numunu, which just means the people. So maybe it's something like that. But it's just, it's itching my brain. I need an answer. Why did you change the name of this tribe?
Maybe they all die out in this season and then they're replaced. You know, somebody else moves in.
Except they said in the second movie, they've been around since the 19th century at least.
Do we think there's a good reason for it? Like, did they, do we think
I don't think it's an accident. Like, they didn't just accidentally do it. So there must be a reason.
I hope so. Yeah.
But I'm like, speak on it. Say it. Tell me.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe. It would almost be like, what's the point of being so meticulous on the Maddie thing that we just talked about, and then being so sloppy on this? It has to be for a reason. I think you're right.
Don't just,
you
like,
said that to me.
Yeah, you don't trip into just making up this whole other name.
You don't accidentally write Scottawapscott.
Yeah, exactly.
Do we think, since they are made up names, if they were trying to make everybody, I just think the fact that they both start with an S sound is going to, people will not even notice that. A lot of people, I didn't notice until I'm seeing them written that it was a different name, right? And so I'm wondering, like, how obvious are they trying to make this? If they're making up a name, they didn't go for something that necessarily stands out, maybe, for your average viewer, I wonder, though. So is this, like, Easter egg level detail, right? Like, there's some lore for it that will get hinted at, but they're not really trying to telegraph it very strongly.
Because
it's a very
blink
and you miss it thing.
I'll keep my eyes peeled. If there's any subtle answers, you'll hear it here, folks. I wanted to, by the way, speaking of theories, I wanted to shout out Rita Reborn's theory from last episode about it being stronger in the past. I think we got a few pieces of support for that this episode, including hearing that this is a milder cycle than the prior two.
The funny thing about that, though, is that feels a little knock on wood to me. I'm like, this isn't done yet, y'all. What are you doing counting bodies yet? The chickens haven't all hatched. Though, do we know they're seven are dead? We don't know many of those, right? Like, I feel like we only can account for a couple of deaths. Maddie, Phil, or the four kids? So who are the other three?
I'm not sure, but I mean, we never know.
And there's a 16-year-old.
In the modern time, we don't, like, you know, in the novel, in the current timelines of the novel, we don't really know. We only see our losers club, not all the other kids who die.
Right. And I mean, there's a few others that they encounter, obviously. But, you know, Rita Reborn, by the way, Rita Reborn, shout out, has definitely read more Stephen King than any of us, which is pretty cool to... in the Discord to have folks that really know their lore. But like, I wonder, we don't have that number in the It novel timeline to be able to test this theory, right? Is it only 15 people overall that are disappear and five people die? Like, I don't know. It's hard to really know, but also like, how well do they know? Are they tracking it, right? How accurate is their information? They're trying, obviously, which nobody else is, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I'm... Okay, Mark, plug your ears for this, but I was wondering, they're educating a prospective keeper, this woman we see there. Mm-hmm. I wonder if she could end up with Taniel. And then the... other thing that they talked about is the augury, is what they call, like, the augury is like a prediction of sorts, right? Or is a symbol of things to come, right? But that's what they call the big bloody event that marks the end of a cycle. Like we've already said, it's in the opening credits. It's talked about in the prior movies. The end of 1908 is an explosion at the Ironworks during Easter egg hunt. I wonder if this is, though, an analogy for the real world, you know, where there's something like the atomic bomb in World War II that was like the moment where things have gone too far. We have to pull back.
Yeah, that could be. Also, the augury could be like the sign that we're going to have our peacetime, right? Like they're looking forward to the peace. I think that they see that as the hopeful event in the future.
Right, right.
In the augury, and then 27 years or more or less of peace, they say. So maybe that's what they mean by the augury.
But augury sounds like a lot of violence always, right? So,
yeah.
You know, we don't get a sense like the extent that they're trying to fight this or stop it, right? They're tracking it, but... are they kind of biding their time until there is a horrific event? Are they trying to, like, it's kind of an interesting, weird, like, you say they're looking forward to it, but they're looking forward to a mass casualty event seems kind of troubling.
Well, I think what they'd tell you is it would be a huge mass casualty event if we didn't have these boundaries.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, we don't know what actually satiates Pennywise? Like, why? What numbers is it? Like, if they removed the pillars or in the It novel, whatever it is that's keeping him or it in Derry, like, how far would it go? Would it take over the world like they mentioned a few episodes ago? Or would it just, does it get satiated after it eats, you know, 20 kids? And that's just what it is. And why would it, you know, like, think like the biggest predator in the world, right? The sperm whale. The sperm whale doesn't eat the entire ocean. Eventually it stops eating squid and it just goes about its business, you know, and till it gets hungry again. So I don't know. It remains to be seen, but probably won't ever be explained or seen. So there we go.
Well, I do think there's a lot of questions about the scope of it. Like, will it just, you know, disappear or not? There's a question later, I know, that, I don't know. Alicia, do you raise this in the feedback of, like, was it eating dinosaurs? What was...
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talked about this a bit last week, and then it came up in the feedback. But yeah, I was wondering what your take was on that was going to be.
I do think... You want to just read the email now so that we're already done with it? It's kind of relevant here.
Sure. Okay. It's from Bobby R. Bobby says, "Hey folks, Bob from New York here. Last episode, you guys were talking about if Pennywise only eats children, and the answer is no, according to the movies at least. The opening scene of Chapter 2, there's a violent hate crime, and it eats the man after he's been beaten and thrown in the river, so he eats at least adults. Makes me wonder if he ate animals and dinosaurs prior to human existence. My thoughts are, if he comes out of hibernation only to feed when the natives witnessed it, is it because he was awake and feeding probably on wild animals? Love you guys, keep up the lore." And yeah, just to clarify that we've been talking about the adults, and we've brought up Adrian a few times, but it prefers eating children. And Mark, do you want to clarify why prefers eating children over adults?
They feel fear more, right? So they have more vivid imaginations, right?
It's like veal, scare, you know.
Right. Yeah. More flavorful, I guess.
Especially if you tenderize it with adrenal.
But we don't know what happens when it doesn't eat, right? So if the tribe was keeping to their sort of rules of let's all stay out of the Western Wood for generations and generations, was it not eating anything until the colonists, and did it have a hibernation cycle in that same way? We don't really know. So it's possible it was eating animals, possible it was eating dinosaurs or whatever else would exist millions of years ago. But it's also possible, I said this last week, possible it just doesn't eat. It's a supernatural creature, right? It may not be eating for calories. It may be eating just because it has a drive to do so, to the extent that it's even really eating, right?
Because pizza's tasty, yeah.
Exactly. You know, I think that I'm a little biased because I just started Attack on Titan over the weekend, and there's this whole idea of, like, the Titans don't need to eat. They eat for fun. They're, for some reason, they just love to eat humans.
Mm.
And, I feel like that's kind of the Pennywise thing, right? Like, I don't think he dies because he doesn't eat, right? But also...
I always thought that, like, he filled himself up and then went back to hibernate for 37 years.
But what happens if he doesn't? If it doesn't like fill itself up, will it just stay awake hunting for millions of years and never, like, we don't know, right? And
yeah.
Maybe it hibernates no matter what. It has a clock. Maybe it eats rats. I don't know.
But it's really, I mean, it's not always 37 years, because between the two cycles in the It book and movies,
I think it's always 27 years, right? Yeah. When is it ever 37 years? But also, we don't know that it's always anything, right? We don't know what it was in 1700s. I mean, that's the thing, is we only know what is recent history, right?
Right. Since 1908.
I mean, I think the fact that it appears as this, like, zombie elk to the Native Americans who first came to the Derry area, I do think that it probably was fucking with the animals. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have phrased it that way. But you know what I mean? It was messing with the animals. It was feeding on the animals. And I, you know, my headcanon is he's scaring these animals because animals exhibit fear, right? You can make that have cortisol in Will's, you know, Will's estimation. But also, then the humans come along and he's like, oh, I've been bored and this looks more fun. Like, there's just so much more you can do with human fear because we have imagination, right? Like, we can imagine things that are not real. And so I think he would much prefer humans, but I think he probably could subsist on non-humans.
I wonder how Pennywise would be today, because apparently, so kids are easier to scare, or you can scare them in more hallucinatory ways, and adults are scared in more abstract ways. But like, if you just show an adult an inbox with like 3,154 unread emails, and
that's just adults have anxiety.
It is kind of weird, like how this would maybe change over generations, right? And cultural changes, like what people are afraid of changes, obviously, generationally, right? If we go back to like 1650s or whatever in New England, there's a lot of witch fear or whatever, right? But if you go to, you know, the 80s or whatever, 70s, it's going to be Cold War fear. But I wonder if people's capacity for fear stays constant, right? If certain types of cultures, certain types of eras, the kids are raised to be more resilient against fear versus like this doesn't matter, but it's just interesting. Like, would that also, as fears change, does the amount of flavor change with it? Because society's like, are we in a fear? We're in a, like, I feel like hate and anxiety might be more prominent in our society now than fear. I think when my parents were kids and it was, you know, duck and cover drills, there might have been a lot more fear for the end, whereas we're all more like angry and wound up and holier than thou and all sorts of other versions of fear. That I wonder, like, which would Pennywise prefer?
Yeah, I mean, I think let's save part of that discussion for later, because I think we're going to talk about Major Hanlon and whether he can feel fear, right? Whether it can affect him. And the answer is yes. So let's move on to the Shawshank Express. Mark, you want to read that one?
On his way to be transferred to Shawshank Prison, Hank Grogan survives an assassination attempt by Phil and Susie's dad. The bus doesn't make it to Shawshank, instead getting derailed by an attack on the way. Hank escapes and runs to Ingrid, who was his affair partner. Ingrid goes to Charlotte for help. Okay.
So there's can someone explain to me, because I don't fully get it, the connections that we're supposed to be making between Ingrid Marsh, not Marsh, what's her last name?
Kirsch.
Kirsch. Is she supposed to be the elderly woman that adult Bev hallucinates when she goes back home?
Probably.
Well, it's Pennywise is copying her, just like Pennywise is himself a copy of this real Ingrid Kirsch's father, Bob Gray.
Okay. We don't really know
in that.
Yeah, we don't really know anything about Mrs. Kirsch backstory wise, as far as I can recall in the story, except that she's a hallucinated neighbor kind of for Bev.
Which she said her father was Bob Gray, which is and we saw in this season, we saw the young girl clown that seems to be the same person. And so we wondered, because Stanley, the cleaver, the butcher, he said his last name is Stanley Kirsch. So indeed, she is Mrs. Kirsch, but I don't think she's 100 or something years old for the 2016 storyline or whatever it was. I think that is Pennywise mimicking her. She's joined his repertoire, but that means we don't know now. Is she actually trying to protect Lily, or is she trying to protect the entity from Lily and her friends by saying, don't go into the sewers, blah, blah, blah. But I guess not, because the entity wants Lily to go into the sewers. But people keep pointing out she's often has like a red jacket on or red cardigan on or something, and that red is the,
I just didn't get a chance to say in the last couple episodes. She is like the worst person to be working as a housekeeper in a mental hospital. I mean, she's just if Lily's really having delusions here, she is absolutely encouraging those delusions, right? Like, oh yeah, I believe you, and this is all real, and like, my God, she's giving she's like undoing the treatment of the medical professionals.
undoing the ineffective treatment of the, yeah.
That's
fair. She's like at this stage, better. Like there's certainly not anything good happening at that asylum. But, I'm just like, this is the worst person to work with psychiatric patients.
It is you all are reading the book way more recently than me. And I don't know, are you far enough in, Alicia, to get to the curse, Mrs. Curse scene yet?
No, but I know that she is mentioned in the book, and she's the head housekeeper, not hospital. At the asylum. Well,
so
but
what
at
I don't
hospital.
Remember is, was there, and I don't think there was, but I don't remember for sure. Is there a connection between her and Bev? Like, is there some, because most of the scares, but not all the scares, relate to something very specifically the person is afraid of, right? But adult Bev in that context goes to, her old house, and my dad isn't here. There's this woman, this nice woman who comes in and talks, and then she turns into a monster. But I don't remember if
who talks about her own father.
So they both, it's sort of just exploiting the similarities of they both had these rough dads and stuff like that. Yeah.
Daddy
so
issues.
I think,
yeah.
John, I don't think we have any reason to really think there is a connection actually, except that Pennywise has chosen to sort of absorb this woman's identity into his oeuvre in the same way that Bob Gray, the clown, becomes kind of, Pennywise becomes, takes that clown as his favorite personage, even though maybe, 200 years ago, he probably wasn't the clown. Like he saw this clown, right. Went, I bet people would think he's creepy. But we could be wrong, and there could actually be some more connection. But if so, I think that's invented for this story, and let's see what happens.
How do we feel about the reveal that Mrs. Kirsch, Ingrid, is the married white woman whom Hank is sleeping with, and seeing Stanley, Smiley Stanley, who didn't want to help Charlotte break up that fight with the boys, he seems like he could be physically abusive, but at least is emotionally abusive at home. He's really a jackass to Mrs. Kirsch and in front of Lily.
You know, I think that there is a couple things here. There is the very common thing where people go, I had no idea he was such a gentleman in public, right? Like there's so many men who put on a really kind face in public, but are actually very abusive at home. But also, like, those men often see kids, especially young girls, as, like, disposable, non-human. Like, I don't have to worry about you. He doesn't think he's exposing himself as an abuser in front of Lily. He thinks he's abusing his wife in front of a dog, right? Like, that's the kind of thing he's viewing himself as doing here. And I didn't trust him from the moment he was like, they call me Stanley Cleaver, and holds up the cleaver. I was like, I don't like that.
Well, when we heard the name Kirsch, I mean, book readers were just like, okay, or even keen-eared folks from the films. I mean, to the point of the twist, they got me because I was putting in my notes like, no, there's no way. Why would he just go into her of all people? He's hiding in her backseat. And it's like, oh, of course, right? But it is interesting to the whole question before a couple weeks ago about is the fate... Does he perceive Stanley as so bad that, again, the consequences of being caught with his wife is worse than being murdered in Shawshank a week later for being a child killer? And, like, is it so much worse? And also, like, he still made that decision to have that affair. So, like, it's a weird, like, we'd sort of just take it as evidence of how messed up Derry is.
I'm not gonna blame either of them for the affair. I think that what he has here is he's like, there's one situation he knows the affair is real. It's a real thing that's happened, and he wouldn't get his day in court is what he's saying, and with good reason. Whereas he knows he's innocent of the child murder, and yes, he's holding back on this alibi, but I think he sees himself as having a better shot there, and at least there being a day in court. And of course, yeah, he's got to watch his back in prison if he ever made it there, but he didn't. So we saw, okay, we know Pennywise was there when he got arrested. We saw the father try to go after Hank, and the father, by the way, wearing a red shirt. But then we saw that Pennywise cop in the doorway with the buck teeth smiling through the door. But why, what was the goal of attacking that transport? Was it to, was it something related to Mrs. Kirsch? Does Pennywise already have a connection with Mrs. Kirsch and knows that he's having an affair with her? Or is it to sew up more bad feelings in Derry and make sure that Hank isn't taken out of Derry for some reason? Do you guys have theories about
Can
that?
Can I just say real quick about the father who, the grief father that tries to shoot him? It feels a little bit like it was about, it was almost an out, the Outsider reference. If anybody's read that or seen that, it doesn't end the same way, but that's very much, that story hinges on a convicted child murderer who a guy attempts to kill when he's on his way to face his day in court. And it goes differently, but that's very much at the beginning of that story. And it, it, it felt like they have to be aware of that. That was an HBO miniseries a few years ago. It doesn't mean anything. There's no way. I mean, The Outsider takes place 50 years later or whatever, but felt kind of like a nod. To the question you're asking, do we have any reason to actually think it is Pennywise that overturns that truck? Like, sure, it could be, but it could just be something else, right?
Yeah.
But why is a really good question. I don't...
I mean, I would say... I would say based on what they said in the episode and how they showed Pennywise lingering around the scene beforehand, that I take the Pennywise part as a given. But I think there could be a few different reasons why. And I'm interested to see if it connects back to Mrs. Kirsch or if it's just general sowing discord.
Can you highlight what the reasons why, aside from just improbability?
I don't remember exactly what he said when he talked about the transport being attacked, but I took that immediately as that on its own. I took as one piece of quote unquote proof. Yeah. The other thing is that cop in the doorway I was just talking about, who was obviously influencing the father, but just was generally hanging around Hank being loaded on the bus. And just, yeah, logically.
Yeah, it is kind of a weird thing for it to want to do, right? Kill these possible criminals, but maybe save one of them?
I mean, I could see several reasons why. Maybe.
Yeah.
We could go different ways, is what I'm saying. Yeah, I was just wondering if you guys had any prevailing
theories. I just don't at this point. Like, no. I have nothing going on. And we got a lot to go through, so I'm going to move us on to preparations, which shouldn't be too long in one because it's mostly just set up for the next scene. Rose confronts General Shaw about Daniel's detainment. He confesses that he remembers the Galoo. Rose retrieves the weapon made from its home, and while she has reservations about Shaw's plans, she gives the military the dagger for Daniel's use. She tells Daniel to keep it close and he will be safe. Leroy, finally let in on the plan, moves his family onto the base to be free from Derry. Lily visits Ingrid at home with her abusive husband, the Butcher, and promises not to enter the sewers. She proceeds to immediately make plans to enter the sewers.
So, okay, about Leroy taking his family to the base. I mean, Will still needs to go to school, right? And is the base safe, or is the base inside Derry or not?
I think it's outside the boundaries.
Okay. But Will still needs to go to school, or do they have a school
shopping? They're going
to
go into town. I think he might just be thinking, right. Well, it's one thing to like go there sometimes, but to like his kid got attacked when they were or like stalked in the middle of the night, right? So, oh, well, we won't be sleeping there. Like, I don't know. This is probably inept.
But also fishing,
which I guess was within Derry. This is probably a futile adult feeling like they have control over a situation, right? I'm not sure he's thought that through. Because they're going to go to Derry sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if he will be going to school or grocery shopping or anything like that. Because I wonder if if Leroy thinks that this is going to end quickly, right? Because they're infiltrating, They're wrapping. He thinks they're wrapping up the mission here. They're going to put the leash on the thing, and then it'll be done.
Yeah, one day at home. Yeah,
yeah. Maybe good a point. Few. That's days. Probably you right. Know, he misses a few days of school. Whatever, but maybe a week at most. But you know, better than him being in the target of this thing. And I think that's fair. You know, if I thought that was going to be wrapped up in a week, yeah, sure. But let's keep him out of the supernatural crosshairs for a week. He could miss a week of school. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how this whole thing works. I think he's just kind of DeLulu a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's listening to Shaw is just a lie, make liar face Liarton, just like constantly every chance he has, he just lies stupidly and then is caught a minute later and is like, oh yeah, I lied about that. Here's the truth. And so you can't trust a single thing that he says. He's really like, I wanted to, you know, say, oh, maybe I shouldn't jump to conclusions because he's, you know, this white major in the 60s. But no, he's really crappy. I don't think that he's racist per se, but I just think he's a bad person. I just don't think
it's going to be enough of a choice when he becomes Red Hulk later. You know, it's already foreshadowing it too much.
Right. But yeah, it just like stupid things like saying Halloran flipped through Taniel's mind, he says to Rose, like the morning paper, which is just A, phrased really cruelly for no reason. And he says that immediately after he just said, oh, Taniel told us the truth. You know, like he just keeps changing to find the cruelest way, it feels like, to stab at Rose and make Taniel sound bad to her. And she's not buying any of it, to her credit, but she just must be so heartbroken to have that kid she had this bond with grow up into this and lying McLiarton man.
Right. How many nice young boys have become cruel old men?
I thought it was weird that Shaw is telling Leroy about this. Like, we apparently just did this psychic expedition and some of this information maybe Shaw already knew. So like, what's the point of doing this really harmful deep dive into Taniel's mind? But then we don't see Halloran explaining it to Shaw and Leroy. We don't see Halloran explaining it to Leroy by himself. Like, it's a weird, the way they set it up is a weird chain of information that really does call into question sort of the integrity, so to speak, of Shaw. Like, it's just a weird kind of the way they skip those next scenes when they come in. What happened? We don't see any of that. And so we don't.
Yeah, it was probably in a memo. We just didn't see it.
Yeah, it was in the email, right? Yeah. And it's just, yeah, he comes away worse. You know, and this whole plan is just, I mean, we'll get into it, but the whole plan is so stupid that, like,
yeah,
I believe that he's a bad, his brain doesn't work well enough to be a good general. Like, and he's a part of that would be lying and treating his people in a weird way. And maybe he's not racist with a capital R, but it doesn't mean he's not a bad general and a bad dude. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think he's dumb in the way that is actually quite realistic, where he's refusing help from Rose and other experts on this very topic. But then he's a special kind of stupid that I guess it is a recurring trope in Stephen King stories when in regards to the military, where it's a sort of like Frankenstein thing, this hubris that makes them go too far. And so his plan is, who was it? Was it Davy Mack or someone was saying on the Discord, like, step A, cage the glue. Step B, ? Step C,
profit.
End the Cold War.
This is so stupid. And this is where I'm like, okay, you're playing with fire, show. I hope this works out. And I know it's like, there's a little bit of like different mix here. There's a little bit of Stranger Things in here. There's a little bit of Alien, Weyland-Yutani. Like, the story is about like the hubris of man in a way that like it sort of isn't as much. But still, like, step one, can we just fast forward a little bit to just talk about the plan for a second? Not beyond this episode, but they're going to go in. One team is supposed to get, whatever that means, or like, I don't remember what they say, but get these pillars, at the moment that you get them, are you, you don't have 13 teams that are each grabbing one and grabbing the stone and moving closer to, like, how do you, how does somebody, like, this is a video game, a JRPG, you're going to collect the stones, and then what? When you pick up that stone, you've just broken that line of the barrier. They're going to bring it in. Let's say they contain it, which makes no sense to me. Then they create this new little box for it. They drop it over Moscow. How do they get it back in the box? Like, I understand that it's the hubris of man, but like they have not thought at it's all Russia's problem, then. Through this.
No. I mean, I think the idea is like, yeah, it's Russia's problem and they just don't care. About, you know, the fact that the people live there too. But it is, you know, it's like, how would this end the Cold War? Just because they want to they want to kill Russia? They want to commit genocide? Because fear is what's driving the Cold War. You just amp up the fear more and it's going to turn it into a hot war. Maybe they think
they'll just feed on Khrushchev and then go to sleep for 27 years and they could worry about it in 27 years.
It is one of those things though, like where they're riding the line between, well, we're making a point about how stupid powerful people can be, and dumb writing that's lazy. Like, and I just don't know yet. Like, this something about the mission in the sewers struck me as just false here. And so I'm hoping that the broader point here is not just a lazy way of telling us that, a kind of dumb way of telling us that the military and the government is kind of corrupt and short-sighted. Like, because it's just, no general is going to think so few steps ahead.
I don't know. What was the next step in MK Ultra, right? What was the next step in the time in Montauk time travel
right.
nonsense, right? Like, there are a million wild military expeditions that have no step two.
So yeah, because Shaw talked about he took some drug that made him get his memories back, and so I hope they tell us what the drug is and why they were experimenting on Shaw, because the military must have had a reason to target him. But since you brought up MK Ultra, do you want to talk about what that is?
I don't know a lot about it. Here. You seem to know more about it. I think they just gave him Valium.
Okay, so I copied this from the NIH report on MKUltra. This is just a summary that sounds very on point for this. Beginning in the 1950s, the U.S. government collaborated with pharmaceutical companies and research universities to develop LSD as part of a campaign of psychological warfare. Though planned to be used against enemies, the program instead exploited U.S. service members to develop hallucinogens as a form of chemical warfare that could render enemy troops mentally incapacitated. And then it says later in that report, the military's research on LSD ended in 1963, which is the year after the show, not because of the unethical aspects of the research, but because the effects of LSD were so unpredictable that the drug could not be effectively weaponized. So that is, you know, if substitute Pennywise for LSD, and that's exactly what's going on here.
Like, I guess we'll do it another time. Well, why don't we get going, because we have a lot of stuff to go through here.
Okay, but just pointing that out. And then I know Firestarter is I know we don't have time to get into it, but that's apparently linked to the MK Ultra stuff because the parents were tested on, and that's why they had the Firestarter kid.
Right, I haven't read Firestarter, but apparently I've heard people talking about it, and like there's a part of the government called the shop that is sort of the Hawkins lab, the like part of the government that does this kind of experimentation. So it's quite possible that intersects here very directly, that we could even see that name. But again, I don't know anything about that novel specifically.
Okay. All right. John, can I just ask you, do you think that Rose gave Daniel the dagger to protect himself or to stab the glue? Oh, I don't
think
stabbing
the glue would work, and I think she knows that based on the legend.
Okay.
I think she knows that everybody else is going to die.
Because I've seen.
So, you know, you just stay alive.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the sewers.
Yeah, I thought it was weird, though, on that dagger that, like, they said that it would pose no threat to us or something like that. They didn't let him hold on to it, but they said something about that dagger posing no threat to the soldiers. And I was like, it's a sharp, heavy piece of rock. Like, it was just such a weird, I don't know, they've lost me on any sort of, the oxymoron of military intelligence is really like hitting hard in this. So yeah, we can leave it.
Typical Stephen King trope, yeah.
All right, let's get into the sewers because we're running out of time here. Armed with Mommy's Little Helper. This is the sewers junior, by the way. Armed with Mommy's Little Helper, which three should probably be enough of. Mm-hmm. The kids enter the sewers from a drain pipe. That was in the Barrens, right? That was the same one that the kids enter into in the It movies. Meanwhile, the kids find the corpses of Phil, Teddy, Susie, just in time for Maddie to transform into it in all its Pennywise glory. The kids run and Lily gets left behind. Pennywise opens its jaws to consume Lily, but is stopped by the dagger, which had floated in front of her. He retreats. I try to always do, oh, flute. I love the way that Bill Skarsgård says
flute. There was a few floating references this episode. Lily said the whole thing. My dad used to say that people are either anchors or lifeboats. They drag you under or they keep you afloat, which is like, you don't want to float. Float's a bad thing. And then she says, yeah, are you lifeboats? So they're floating down there. And then Lily compares the Valium to laughing gas. I thought I was floating right out of my, oh, are you two holding hands?
That is we didn't so talk funny. About, yeah funny. No.
She's like, so no. Cute. He goes, yes.
I love that. Yes.
So the moment, CG or not, like we've established that millions of rows of teeth or whatever, that's a Pennywise look in this series. And that moment when it's charging and then stops is so cool. It's such a great scare, but also you get this moment of a bright light on this really disgusting clown face. And yeah, you really, really well done part, like culmination sort of that little part of the scene.
Really original, visually original reveal with the teeth starting in the back of the head. And
yeah, I thought that was great. Yeah. I think we kind of talked about, the CGI being better in this episode, so we skip that part, but don't take that much Valium, everybody. Like I mean, don't take Valium at all. It's not really approved for. I don't. Is it still approved for use at all? I don't know.
No. Yeah. No, it is. It's a short term effect. It's not. If you want long term medication of that sort, then you want an SSRI.
Sure, but even for something like this, a benzo, you're gonna get like Xanax now, right? Like it's been functionally replaced by second generation benzos. Okay. I think
it does not work to ward off Pennywise hallucinations. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah. And apparently Leroy's amygdala also doesn't stop the hallucinations, but he reacts differently. And it's like Pennywise can almost use that against him.
Yeah, does he react better?
Because he
almost shoots his own kid, right? He reacts differently. He's not good prey, but he's not necessarily good soldier against it any better, right?
He's almost a Henry in this situation, right? Henry Bowers. Like, he can twist them into being what he needs.
Yeah. Can I just say before we start, because it looks like we're about to dive into the adults again, do we think those are actually the corpses of Phil, Teddy, and Susie, or that's just a Pennywise hallucination?
I think they are legitimately dead. Yeah,
I think
don't know
that
whether
was Pennywise hallucination.
That could
be. Yes. Too perfect to be right there as they walk in.
Mm-hmm. But they're probably dead.
Oh, yeah. So. They're so dead. So dead. Yeah. Let's get to the sewers senior. Leroy leads a team into the same sewers through the Nebalt Street house. Once down there, he sees Charlotte begging for help. She transforms into a monster and he shoots her, telling his partner Polly to shoot anything that should not be down here, no matter if he knows them or not. Tanya loses the dagger in a chase and Dick Halloran is pulled under by it. Inside Dick's mind, Pennywise takes the form of his abusive grandfather. He shoots Halloran's grandmother and forces Dick to open his mental lockbox. While approaching the exit, Leroy encounters his son and moves to pull the trigger. Polly realizes it isn't an illusion and stops Leroy by stepping in front of the gun, taking a fatal wound. At the end of the episode, Dick walks out of the sewer and finds a dead Polly.
Yeah. So I just want to shout out the Uncle Sam scare.
So good.
Is it was an effective one and also on point for, you know, they would be worried about being
did you see,
by the military.
Did you see it coming when you saw the hand? How fast did you two catch that?
Yeah. That it was going to be Uncle Sam? Yeah. No, not until I saw the face.
Oh, there's something about that hand. Yeah, I knew. Yeah. And I was proud of myself for knowing.
Okay, okay.
I was a whole 3 seconds ahead of the audience.
The way it's pointing.
It was great.
Yeah.
So weird, but cool.
I liked how they're like gas main leak, and then they're invading the entire military on this street. But it is, so we had this whole debate about whether the house was already a wreck. And it is already a wreck. It's in the same state it is in the 80s and 30 years after that. So is it just magically maintained in this permanent state of disrepair and nobody dares to tear it down?
Who owns that house? Like, did you have hire contractors to go in and make it messy again? Like, or like,
there's even a car that's parked outside in the movie, the same exact place, like this old punch buggy, as in at this point in the timeline. So like nobody's touching that property.
I think it might be a plot hole, but we're not supposed to worry about it. Yeah. We can headcanon.
Well, I think it's intentional. Like they went to great lengths to show that it's.
But
exactly
I don't know that
same.
That. So okay, sorry everybody. I wonder, rewinding all the way back to episode one, is this beyond the powers of Pennywise? Forget about the house on Ebolt Street. I mean, it's fascinating, but like we could argue about how is that possible? Can Pennywise be in so many places at once? Because Pennywise is very literally doing stuff like he is Maddie. Because we encounter Pennywise earlier in the episode, not Pennywise the clown, but like, it is doing stuff in Derry throughout other points of this episode, right? It's not just at the end. Am I crazy? I feel like there's stuff with Dick Halloran or something earlier. But
I think two things. One is that I think this is another support of Rita Reborn's theory that Pennywise is stronger in the past. But I also had a thought, like, what if Pennywise did at some point have offspring? You know, we talked about the eggs that were destroyed in the original movie. What if there actually was more than one? What if Mrs. Kirsch is actually, I don't know, because she seems like she's got this whole life, or her husband.
Well, so that right there would be, if we think Pennywise messed up that truck going to Shawshank, which, first of all, that's outside of Derry, right? Unless it's not somehow.
Well, they wasn't allowed to leave.
Pennywise is there. Pennywise is also Maddie with the kids in their hangout at the standpipe, right? So, or wherever, I think that's where they are. Like, Pennywise is very much in two places at once. And even if we say in the sewer, he's in seven different places at once, we could say, well, that's Pennywise's lair more. Maybe he's kind of not. But I don't know that Pennywise in any era is supposed to be able to be. Like, if you remove the barriers, can Pennywise be in South Africa and in Norway at the same time messing with people? Or is Pennywise a entity that...
I mean, I think that's a different question than can Pennywise be two places in the same town, which is a legit question, which is either, Pennywise is stronger or they're... I mean, this is another crackpot, really reach in theory, but what if Pennywise did have offspring and they managed
and
to
I
kill
hope
them? The offspring.
I hope that it's intentional and they give us a little bit of nugget explaining it, because it's another one of those where I'm hoping it's not just sort of them playing too fast and loose. Because like you can play fast and loose, but if you're choosing to do a prequel that is not fast and loose, a prequel that adds to the lore and like milks this and lures us in, you owe us some amount of consistency, right? Like, you can't do House of the Dragon and just break stuff. You have to, like, if you're choosing to do that, treat it with care. So I'm hoping that's what, I'm not saying this is breaking, but it might be. And so these are the things that make me go,
I trust.
Oh, I have more trust.
I'm willing to give these writers a little grace here to wrap it up by the end of the season.
Yeah.
Or at least explain it.
Still three episodes left.
We have two more seasons ostensibly of this. So I think they're going to have to save some mysteries for those two seasons. I was surprised to see a flashback to 1908 already, because now we're, you know, already expending some of that material. But we'll see. But I know we have to get you out of here, Mark. So why don't we just talk about one other thing, at least, the orange light in the lockbox, the lockbox in general. Like, what, I know that's a Dr. Sleep reference. There's something there. And I guess my question was, did that unlock Halloran's ability to see dead people, or did that, was that like an entity in there?
It's confusing. You've read Dr. Sleep, right? Seen the film, Alicia. Like, this, we talked about this one of the last episodes. Like, the lockbox is the way, it's his trap, Ghostbusters trap, basically. He throws it under the ghost. Ray stomps on the thing. It opens up, and Slimer gets pulled into the trap for the containment unit. And so it's weird to see his grandfather, which is probably not a grandfather ghost, it's probably Pennywise, holding the lockbox, because the point of the lockbox is he's put his grandfather in the lockbox. The ghosts that he doesn't like get trapped in the lockbox, where they just sort of can't bother you anymore. So the idea that his grandfather is holding it suggests that's not his grandfather. But then, essentially, if you remember to Ghostbusters, that moment when the EPA guy, Peck or whatever, forces them to open the containment unit and all the ghosts escape, I think that's what would happen if you opened that lockbox. Metaphysical lockbox is just ghosts that he's trapped in his recent years would escape. To what end? It almost has nothing to do with it or Pennywise, right? So kind of weird, like orange light, like Polly's eyes, its eyes, like these things shouldn't be related. It's really interesting if they are.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't Polly's eyes, I mean, Polly's dead. Yep. He's a ghost, obviously. We saw him die. But then when we see those whited over eyes in the film, it means they've looked into the deadlights. And we have seen the deadlights as those three white circles, is how they represent them in the film, and how they, we saw that in the flashbacks about the glue. So how that relates to that orange light in the lockbox, which, you know, we've talked about the orange light, the yellow eyes, this is deadlights, stuff. So I don't, how it all relates together is a good question, but R.I.P. Polly, he was a real one. I don't know why Pennywise didn't let him see the scare, but he still understood what was going on. And in the official podcast, apparently the behind the scenes headcanon that was agreed on by Andy Muschietti is that Polly saved Leroy when he got his brain damage, that amygdala brain damage issue. Polly is the one who saved him. So he's just constantly there saving Leroy, saved his son, and saves Leroy. And even absolves him, right?
He's like, oh, it's fine. Just, I'm good. I'm good. Just let me go.
We could have used more of him because he ends up, he's true blue. And he didn't see the deadlights, right? He was just shot, right? So this is, it's interesting because this is a question, but it's not just a question. It's the episode cliffhanger. Sort of, right? And I'm thinking, like, the experience of people who have seen Dr. Sleep or read Dr. Sleep and those that aren't is very different. And so they're treating this as very important to the story. Whereas three episodes ago when we were dropping the knowledge about what happened in Dr. Sleep with Halloran shining, it felt a little more Easter egg-y, like, well, it's just some context for understanding what's going on here. That's not true at all. It's actually, like, very much a part of this story, to the point that it's the last shot in the episode. So I think we are all book readers of the Stephen King mythos are all pretty much in the same boat in terms of not knowing what's going to happen next as the non-readers.
This is exciting. Well, I think we did it, folks. We wrapped up this episode just in time. I'll do the outro by myself, but Mark, Alicia, thank you for joining me on another episode of Welcome to Derry.
Thank you. Glad to have you back.
Hello, everyone. I'm just getting my feet wet coming back to the podcast. So if I miss something, sorry, you'll probably hear about it on one of our other episodes. But here's what I do know it's going on. Pluribus is getting full coverage. David's handling that with Nicole from Nevermind the Music. And that's, I hear, a great series. I'm hoping to catch up on it by the end of the season. So go check that out. That's a Vince Gilligan sci-fi something. We also have coverage of The American Revolution Show with David and Brian 8063, also known as Usul, covering all that historical goodness. Now, Brian, as you know, is a historian, and he's been a supporter and a moderator in our community for quite a while, and he's contributing his voice to this entire series, which is great. I can't wait to catch up and listen to all that. You can also catch up on all of our affiliates. Radioactive Rambling is just about to do Fallout Season 2, and I think that's going to be a big show for this year. You're also going to have more from Properly Howard Movie Review soon. Just two buds talking about movies. Wool Shift Dust, I'm sure we'll be back with some holiday goodness. And of course, you know that Mark, who was on the podcast today, has his own show with Nicole, where they talk about music and psychology and all the intersections there, called Never Mind the Music. And you can find all of these affiliate shows in the link tree in the show notes. Go there, be merry. For now, let me give you the thank yous for our Discord server boosters: Aaron K, Tilly the Thriller, Doof 71, Athena A, Listu, Nancy M, Ghost of Partition, Radioactive Richard, and Adrian. And our lore masters: Samartian, Michael G, Michelle E, SC, Peter OH, Nancy M, Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Andre B, Kwang Yu, Nathan T, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Listu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Kali S, Il Mariel, Paul K, Rocky Zim, Jessica H, Red Zippy, The TCS, Dopamini, Catch It, Ellen R, and Adrian. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back next week with more Derry.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and comments to lorehounds@thelorehounds.com. Get ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts on Patreon or Supercast, and connect with us on Blue Sky and join us on our Discord server. Links for everything are in the link tree in the show notes of this episode. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.